Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Trust excellence built on 40 years of experience. Visit zurichcorporate.ie to learn more about the Zurich Master Trust.
For more on what we've been hearing about in our news there this evening, Israel's defence minister has said an order to attack Gaza's southernmost city of Rafah will be given very soon as families flee after the IDF ordered 100,000 people to evacuate. The Israeli Defence Forces said it would use leaflets, text messages and phone calls to encourage civilians to move to a nearby humanitarian area. I'm joined now by James Elder, global spokesperson for the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and by Gareth Brown, journalist with The Economist based in the Middle East. You're both very welcome to Drive Time this evening. James Elder, I'll start with yourself, please. How concerned are you about the situation in Rafah this evening?
John, this is everyone's nightmare, particularly those in Rafah. This is what we've warned, pleaded about. This is people who've moved four or five times. When I was last in Rafah last month, I'm looking at children in tents in Rafah who have had amputations, who should be in hospitals, but because of the flow so quickly of children coming in and out of hospitals with the wounds of war, they are there. So coping capacities have been smashed. People don't know where to go. They know their homes have been destroyed in Khan Yunis. That's clear for everyone to see. So they're sent, as you said, to zones in Mawasi. Now, there's a reason why Mawasi doesn't have people living on it in a densely populated area like Gaza. It's because it's sand. Nothing grows there. There's no sanitation. There's no toilets. So again, John, we're in this space of being told there are safe zones. Safe zones get bombed and safe zones don't have any water and sanitation. So yeah, unbearable as it is, though, this is happening and it's going to be horrific.
It comes after 200 days of war and the toll has been tough on the children of the area in particular. You'd be very concerned about that, James.
It's so hard to keep capturing it. When we talk now, 14,000 children have been killed overnight. 8, 9, maybe 10 children have been killed. And it doesn't even raid a headline. 9 or 10 children overnight were killed. Rafah is home to the largest functioning hospital still in Gaza, John. It's European Hospital, so named after the donors from Europe who set that hospital up. That is right on the cusp, European Hospital, of those red zones where people know they must leave. They're under no doubt. If you're told to leave, you run for your life. You just don't know where to go. That includes tens of thousands of people sheltering at European Hospital and hundreds and hundreds with wounds of war who simply cannot leave. They can't. I've seen the second ICU that we helped set up there. I've seen children in those beds with head wounds, you know, with tubes coming through them. Those doctors now have to try and find a way to evacuate those people, presumably to a dusty beach, you know, 5 miles away. None of this makes sense. And it's what we've warned about for so, so long. It's why, again, we keep calling for a ceasefire, which gets you hostages home, gets food in the strip.
And where do they go, James, for further necessary medical treatment as they will need, or is there anywhere?
No, I think that's a good point, John. They don't. We 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip. 10 of those now are partly functioning. The one I just mentioned there, European Hospital, is the largest still functioning in the south. That clearly now is going to be evacuated very, very soon. So at a time when the children of Gaza have never needed healthcare more, it just doesn't exist. Doctors do 36-hour shifts, but they do it without many of the medical supplies they need. But we are down to a fraction of hospitals, and they're going to move to areas without that medical care. Al-Mawasi is the area where they're told to go to. We'll have a population density of 3, 4, 5 times that of New York City, except not a single person will be in high-rise. That's tents side by side by side, not even thinking of where would you get a toilet or a shower or the basics. So people are being denied healthcare and safety. There's also a sense of this denial of dignity, to be quite honest.
I was just going to ask you about that. In terms of water and sanitation, you're looking at huge risk of further illness here in settings like this.
Yeah, they're mind-boggling numbers, John. In Rafah, and again, Rafah now suddenly is going to be a better picture than where they're meant to go to, but it was around one person for 800 plus toilets, and it's about four times that, 3,500 people for a shower. That means an old woman, a teenage girl are queuing all day to get that. Many people I spoke to this morning, I was on the phone to those I've met in Gaza. They're moving to the middle area, not to the safe zones as designated. They're going to the middle area, but that's called Deribala. We know there are literally rivers of sewage in Deribala because, you know, the infrastructure's been blown up. There's no ability to collect waste anymore. So this is this hellscape people are in. And for children, it's 7 months. I mean, we are in uncharted territory when it comes to trauma of these children. UNICEF has said it before. This isn't, Gaza is not a place for children right now. But, of course, it's their home. It has to be their home. But they cannot possibly even begin to recover from this nightmare as it somehow seems to be getting worse.
Tell us more about the situation for humanitarian aid or relief. Is it getting through now?
No, this is now, again, what we feared most. We, UNICEF and others lobbied very heavily for an access point in the north. It's called Erez. It was so critical. When I was in the north last month, John, and I'd be, you know, sitting with women who were crying over skeletal children, that crossing was closed and it was 15 minutes away from getting help. That's opened, and that can be of immense, immense benefit as we get, you know, nutritional supplies to those children. But it cannot be the expense of the real lifeline for Gaza, which is Rafah, that border crossing. It cannot be the expense of that closing. And that's what we fear right now. We fear that will close and then, you know, we get a fraction of the aid supplies in. And again, Mawassi is a very difficult place to try and set these things up. It's important too, I think, John, the safe zone narratives. We spoke about this in November. Legally, it's not just don't bomb it. It's food, water, medicine. But Mawassi, I mean, my colleague met a little boy, Mustafa, in Mawassi 2-3 weeks ago. He was shot in the head while he was going to get parsley for family dinner in a safe zone. Now, Mustafa is no longer with us. Repeat that story time and again, and apparently we're about to do it again now in Rafah.
In a safe zone, you say. So when you hear of humanitarian areas, as it's described by the Israeli Defence Force, what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, it's a dark irony, I think, John. A humanitarian zone that's been designated by the military but not by humanitarians. And again, if the intent had been, if we had seen an intent to, you know, to put sanitation facilities in those, but to put protection, to put the kind of things people need, then that would speak to something. But all we've seen is the same intent, the same way we've seen indiscriminate killing that has killed 14,000 plus children. We've seen that same intent go into, or a lack of intent, go into looking after civilians. So, you know, you can't unilaterally declare a safe zone in a war. That's starters. But also you can't declare it without facilitating humanitarians to get in there and make sure there are toilets and taps and showers.
You said before, James, that in your 20 plus years with the United Nations, you'd never seen anything like the devastation in cities like Khan Yunis and Gaza City. What now do you expect for Rafah?
It's a great question. Honestly, I expected the same to happen again. Otherwise, we're just making the same errors again. We're hoping, you know, we're hoping against hope and hoping for decency, and we haven't seen that. Now, then you get to a scenario, Khan Yunis. We were promised, John, we were promised the South would not endure the ferocity of the North, and then Khan Yunis is flattened 360 degrees, even worse than Gaza City in the North. If the same were to happen to Rafah, as your presenter said at the start, we see a bloodbath, but we also see nowhere left in Gaza. Whenever this horror show ends, however many tens of thousands of children have been killed, there is certainly then nowhere to go.
UNICEF's James Elder, thank you very much for joining me on Drive Time this evening. To Gareth Brown, next, journalist at The Economist. You're joining us this evening from Ramallah in the West Bank, Gareth, and thank you for doing so. Are there any hopes for a ceasefire right now and avoiding what seems like this imminent attack on Rafah?
I think there's still hope. I think what we're seeing unfold in Rafah today with this, you know, IDF command, you know, telling people to evacuate is brinkmanship. We are seeing the stakes are very, very high for a ceasefire. And it's been that way for the last few days. I think we're probably closer now to a ceasefire than we have been for many months. But what we have here is a scenario of Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu looking each other in the eye and seeing who's going to blink first. This Israeli threat to go into Rafah, you know, to defeat these final Hamas holdouts is, you know, it's a really serious threat which will have devastating consequences both for Hamas but also for the people living there or the people seeking shelter there. But there's also a dynamic to this where if Hamas can hold on and you know, prevent the Israelis from going into Rafah, then perhaps they can get something politically out of this. Perhaps they can get a ceasefire which allows them to, you know, release hostages, get some Palestinian prisoners released from Israeli jails and live to fight another day. So the situation is very bleak, but we've seen this, the head of the CIA, William Burns, just today he's been in Jerusalem meeting with Netanyahu. He's been in Doha meeting with the Qatari prime minister. I don't think the chances of a ceasefire happening in the next couple of days, perhaps 48 hours, are dead just yet. I think we're closer than we have been for quite a while.
And what can you tell us, Gareth, of the situation in Rafah right now? Are Palestinians heeding this order? Are people leaving?
Some are leaving, but as James said there, you know, there is the big question of where do they go. But I've spoken to people, you know, in the last couple of hours who are staying put, even though they're in the zones where they've been told to evacuate from, because they believe that this is an Israeli gambit. This is part of the negotiation tactics. This is basically an effort to ramp up even further the pressure on Hamas, on Yahya Sinwar, to blink first, to fold, to accept a temporary ceasefire. You know, we see Hamas are demanding a permanent end to the war, and the Israelis only want to give them, you know, a temporary ceasefire. So some people are leaving, but that's by no means everyone, not yet. And you know, the people I've spoken to are really convinced that this is playing into all of these negotiations which are happening, you know, at the highest levels of government.
It sounds like a dangerous dilemma for ordinary civilians and families there. How far are they expected to go for those who do leave to this humanitarian zone? How practical is this notion of getting out?
I mean, it's not very practical. It's not so far away, but I mean, you have to consider many of these people are sick. They're elderly. They're moving into zones, even in Al-Mawasi, where they could still be killed. You know, we've seen some talk of getting people to go back to the north of Gaza, where things have, you know, relatively speaking, quietened down. It would be easier to get aid in from the north. You know, if Rafah is to be assaulted, then you could start to bring aid in through Erez or crossings which go from Israel into the north of Gaza. In theory, it's all possible, but the reality is there's nowhere safe in Gaza. You know, not for anyone, whether you're a child, a civilian, an elderly person. I think one of the really critical aspects to this is one of the big worries regionally has been if this Rafah operation goes ahead, you might see significant numbers of Palestinians in Gaza attempting to get into Egypt and cross that border illegally, climbing over the wall. You know, you could see this uncontrolled mass movement of people. And for Egypt, that is a worst case scenario, you know, seeing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people crossing into the Sinai Desert. So, you know, if Israel is going to go ahead with this Rafah operation, that's going to be a critical priority for it, ensuring that that doesn't happen, because the regional instability that could lead to, ignoring the humanitarian situation, just putting the humanitarian stuff to one side for a second, the potential instability that could be caused by a mass movement of people from Rafah into Egypt could be vast. So that's going to be a real challenge for Israel. If they go ahead with this operation, they're going to have to find a way to stop people fleeing into Egypt. Do they have the answers to that? I'm not sure they do. Nobody seems to know.
The Israeli Defence Forces will say there's been plenty of warning for this long threatened assault on Hamas holdouts. They say that Rafah harbours thousands of Hamas fighters and some Israeli hostages might be held there too. You say there is still hope of a ceasefire, or is this attack inevitable as they've warned for some time now?
I don't think it's inevitable yet. I think the international pressure on Israel and on Benjamin Netanyahu is so great. You know, we've seen European governments lining up, you know, to say publicly, we don't want to see this happen, whether it's Macron in France, whether it's Rishi Sunak in the UK. We've also seen, you know, we know that the Americans behind the scenes are really urging the Israelis not to go forward with this without a very solid plan for the humanitarian situation in Rafah. And they've said, look, you know, as a matter of fact, we haven't seen that plan. The suggestions the Israelis are putting forward for how they're going to move these people, what they're going to do to take care of the civilians is not sufficient for them to go forwards with this. So I don't think it's inevitable yet. I think we're very, very close. And don't get me wrong, I think there's many people within the Israeli government and the IDF who do want to see it go ahead, you know, sooner rather than later. I think there's that appetite for that from the Israeli security establishment, but I don't think it's inevitable yet, and I still think there's a chance that a ceasefire can be found in the coming days.
Gareth Brown, journalist at The Economist, joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank on Drive Time this evening. Thank you very much.